Somebody asked me before services tonight if tonight we'd get into the fun stuff. That spoke volumes. I know last week going through canonization is not terribly riveting for a lot of us, and I'm not going to berate anybody for that. It's not my favorite thing either. Tonight we do get into the fun stuff. But let's finish up what we started last week. We saw that the Jews last week, prior to the time of Christ, long before the time of Christ, had come to a conclusion that the inspired works of God through men had come to a close. They grouped them as 22 books, we grouped them as 39, but they said the time for God's written revelation is over until the prophet, the Messiah, comes. Now, that might be helpful to us, I think it is a little bit, to know what people who were closer to the occasion believed, but that doesn't really help you and me ultimately come to our own conclusion. Why do I believe that these other books that other people include in their Bibles don't belong in my Bible? And you might say to yourself, well, I believe that God gave us what we need. And that's a good answer. The thing is, for people who don't have the experience with serving God that you do, that might not be a good enough answer. What can we share with them? Well, we saw last week that these apocryphal books that are included in the Roman Catholic Bible and are believed to be inspired by others, number one, have a number of errors in them. Historical, chronological, geographical errors. And of course, if a book is from God, it's not going to have those kinds of errors. God knows what he's talking about. Number two, we didn't get into this last week. We've only got five reasons. There are doctrinal errors in these books. When we're looking at the Old Testament, we are looking at 39 books that, although very diverse, written on three different continents, two different languages, by a whole host of people from different backgrounds, nevertheless, in that diversity, there is a uniformity in theology. They teach the same doctrine. That's not what we find when we look in the apocryphal books. For example, in the book of Tobit, chapter 1, verses 6 through 7, an angel of God tells a man that smoke from the heart and liver of a fish will drive away a demon. Does that sound like the sort of thing we find anywhere in the Bible? No, most certainly does not. In 2 Maccabees, chapter 12, verses 40 through 45, we are taught to pray for the sins of the dead, and we're told that we can make monetary offerings that will help on behalf of the dead. Again, completely contrary to what the other books teach. Furthermore, in the book of Judith, chapter 9, verse 10, the heroine prays to God and says, quote, use the deceit of my lips, quote, end quote, to smite her enemies. What does the Bible say about deceit? Thou shalt not lie. We know this. So these doctrinal errors don't accord with the rest of the books. Furthermore, and this is almost enough on itself, these books do not claim to be inspired. If you and I open up our Old Testament, we're going to find 2,600 plus claims to inspiration. We're going to find 680 of them in the books of Moses, 1,300 in the prophets, and hundreds more elsewhere. Nowhere in the Apocrypha, in these 12 or 14 books, depending upon how you number them and group them, nowhere do we find a phrase like, hear the word of the Lord. The writers seem to have been trying very hard not to claim inspiration. Fourthly, the Jews understood, as do we, that these books were not written during a prophetic age. Now, I'm going to read some quotes that are, of course, not inspired, but I think they're interesting, and since we're studying historical and archaeological evidence confirming the Bible, they're relevant. 1 Maccabees, chapter 4, beginning in verse 45, this is generally regarded as a good historical work, not an inspired work. We are reading in that book about the temple. How many of us remember Antiochus Epiphanes? Does that name ring a bell? Some of us? Okay, he's prophesied in the book of Daniel. Antiochus Epiphanes was trying to get the Jews away from their monotheism. He wanted them to buy right into the polytheism of the Greek world. And so what did he do to the temple and the altar? What did he do on the altar? He offered a pig on it. And then the broth from the pig was taken and poured all over the temple precincts to completely defile it so the Jews wouldn't use it. And they didn't for a number of years. When the Jews finally drove out Antiochus Epiphanes' armies and they cleansed the temple, which began what today is known as Hanukkah, they had these stones that had been defiled. And they didn't know what to do with them. So 1 Maccabees tells us they pulled the altar down, or this part that was the stones were defiled, and they laid up the stones in the mountain of the temple in a convenient place, quote, until there should come a prophet to show them what should be done with them. I thought that was interesting. The Old Testament didn't tell them how to cleanse these things. So they just tore it down, apparently replaced it, and thought, okay, but these stones were sacred. We're not going to toss them. We're going to stick them over here, and we're going to wait until a prophet can tell us what to do. But since they're waiting, what's that tell us? They didn't believe there was a prophet available at the time. 1 Maccabees chapter 9, verse 27, after Judas Maccabees dies, quote, so there was great affliction in Israel, the like whereof was not since the time that a prophet was seen among them. There's no prophet now, and there's not been crying like this since there was. In the Dead Sea Manual of Discipline, it looks forward to the time of the coming of a prophet and the anointed ones of Aaron and Israel. Josephus, bear with me just a little bit longer, please, and we'll get to the fun stuff. Josephus writes this, it is true, our history has been written since Artaxerxes. That's the 4th century BC. Our history has been written since Artaxerxes, very particularly, but... In other words, we've had writers since that time, but it has not been esteemed of equal value with the former of our forefathers because there has not been an exact succession of prophets since that time. And even in the Jewish Talmud, final quote, with the death of Haggai, Zechariah, and Malachi, the latter prophets, the Holy Spirit ceased out of Israel. It was the conviction of the Jewish people, based on things they saw, that there were no more prophets. Finally, for those of us who believe in Jesus, Jesus and the apostles never quoted or cited the Apocrypha. We can find quotations of Old Testament books throughout, but we don't find them quoting or citing the Apocrypha. And that says a great deal, really. We don't have their stamp of approval. We're done talking about that unless some of you have comments or questions. Tim? Okay, Boone's going to bring the mic to you, sorry.
Doesn't Jude, or the last chapter of Peter, maybe it's Jude, mention something that's not in the Bible about somebody?
Jude does reference a prophecy of Enoch, that there is an apocryphal book of Enoch that includes that prophecy, but it doesn't originate with that book. And the same is true of the so-called Assumption of Moses that mentions. Apparently, what we have here is the Jews, and Jude is not an apostle, but although it doesn't matter, he is inspired. What we seem to have here is that there were things passed down through the Jews that were inspired, they knew about, and we have Jude citing them. Have you ever noticed as you're reading through the Old Testament, you'll come across and it'll say, the book of Jasher, the book of Iddo the prophet, the book of Gad the seer. We have the Bible referencing these as books that are reliable and turned to. And they're books of prophets. Do we have them today? No. But apparently some of that information was still available. So that's my understanding of what's going on there. Whoever wrote this so-called Book of Enoch, which is not an inspired work, a reading of it would bear that out, I think, still had information to the same information that Jude did, and so included it as well. But we're not looking at inspired work there, I don't believe. And just study it for yourself if you have any doubts on it. Any other questions? Well, let's move on then to archaeological evidence directly. The slides will get interesting in just a moment. Let's go through the history of what the Bible tells us. Let's take a trip down memory lane for just a moment so that we can be fresh in our minds what the Bible tells us about the children of Israel going through Egypt, coming out of Egypt, and conquering the Canaan land. Who was the first of the Jewish nation to go down in Egypt and stay? Joseph. It was Joseph, right. He was sold into slavery. He goes down there. How old is he when he's sold into slavery? 17 years old. And how long is he in Egypt before he rises to this high position? He's 30 when he rises it to us. He's 13 years. 13 years, he serves Potiphar, he goes to prison, oversees the prison, and finally rises to this position of power. And then after 7 years of plenty, the first year of the famine, thereabouts, it appears, his brothers show up. And it's in the second year, Genesis 45:6 tells us that Joseph reveals himself to them. So 9 years after he's 30, so 39 years old, he reveals himself to them. The whole family comes down, and there begins what we call the sojourn. They live in Egypt. They are treated nicely. They're put over here in the choicest land. And then years later, a man comes to power who doesn't know Joseph. And what does that man see when he looks out at all these people? A huge threat. In fact, the land has filled with them, so much so that when they do finally leave, they have 600,000 men, not counting women and children and the mixed multitude. Probably easily a couple of million people, maybe more. Which, by the way, makes for an interesting thought. How wide did the Red Sea spread? They crossed it at night. That was a big spread. They come out of Egypt after result of all these plagues. And listen to what Exodus tells us about what the condition of Egypt was when finally the plagues were over and the people left. Pharaoh's servants said to him in Exodus 10, verse 7, "Do you not yet know that Egypt is destroyed?" Exodus 12:30, Moses tells us there was not a house where there was not one dead. One died in every home in the death of the firstborn. All the livestock of Egypt died. Think of that. What if all the livestock in the United States died? "The locusts ate every herb of the land and all the fruit of the trees which the hail had left, so there remained nothing green on the trees or on the plants of the field throughout all the land of Egypt. The fish that were in the river died. The Egyptians could not drink the water." When Moses is talking to the children of Israel 40 years later in Deuteronomy 11:4, 40 years later, he says to the people of Israel, "The Lord destroyed the Egyptians, their army, to this day." 40 years had passed, and the nation had still not recovered, Moses said. Pharaoh and his army died in the Red Sea, Psalm 136, verse 15. Now, why do I go through all that? Well, partly this, and I asked this last week. If a nation like Egypt, the world power of the time, or at least one of them, was destroyed to this extent, is it possible, or is it likely, rather, that there would not be, is it likely that there would be no evidence of it having happened? No. Something on this scale is going to leave some trace. So that's where we're going to pick up tonight. The scholars, some of them, will say it never happened. It's a view among some scholarly circles that this whole story I just cited and them going through the wilderness and going into the land of Canaan and taking it all over, it's an invention of Judean scribes who were told to create a heroic past for the nation and a group of laws for the people. Create a mythology for the people that they can buy into and believe. It's just all invented. The more moderate position is, well, something happened, but it didn't happen how, and it didn't happen when the Bible says it happened. That's probably the more popular position among many scholars. Now, we're getting into the archaeology, but we talked last week about the benefit of reason. What are the problems with taking the extreme position that these events described in the Bible never happened? Say someone said to you, "I don't believe any of it. It's hocus pocus." Just on a purely logical level, what might be some of the problems with that position? What's that? Well, it is an assumption. That's true. You could say, what makes you say that? That would be a very good question.
That person's denying the acts of God. I mean, they're denying God himself by saying that it didn't happen.
Well, they might say, "I believe in God, I just don't believe in the Bible." What's that?
Any evidence whatsoever invalidates their position.
Yeah, it's a pretty bold assertion to make because, number one, it assumes that you have all information. And if you don't have all information, you got to hedge your bets, so to speak. But let me share with you this thought. I've been reading a book, and I've got it here for some of you who might be interested in much of what I'm speaking on tonight. I'm drawing from it. There's a man by the name of David Roll. He is a British Egyptologist, and he is an agnostic. That is, he says, I remain unconvinced that there is a God. The jury's out for me. I'm not saying no, but I'm not saying yes. I'm unconvinced. That's an impressive position, but it's really not a very workable or wise position. But he does make an interesting point. He says, you know, it is a little ridiculous to take the position that nothing ever happened, because the Hebrew people for 3,000 years have been celebrating it. They have a whole feast devoted to this. The entire nation has been celebrating this for at least 3,000 years. How likely is it that you have an entire nation all those years ago celebrating a complete fiction? Now, is that a, you know, cold, hard, closed case statement? No, but it's an interesting one. How likely is that? Secondly, an Egyptologist and professor of Near Eastern archaeology, James Hoffmeyer, he makes this statement. Because remember, these people who take this extreme position, they say that this was all just completely fabricated, that the Judean scribes made it up to give the people a mythology they could believe in. He says, who would invent a story about their ancestors being slaves? I can see people saying our ancestors were princes, our ancestors were merchants, our ancestors were something wonderful and glorious and noble, but we were slaves? Why? If you are going to dream up a story, and surely you would surely come up with a better one than that. I think there's a lot of truth in that. If you look at the mythologies of other nations, ancient nations, it is normally great and glorious. We had these ancestors who lived super long, and they were kings, and King Arthur and all this stuff. And I realize Arthur may have been real, although he wasn't like the stories tell. But it doesn't really add up. Now, the more moderate position we'll let the archaeology speak to tonight. The very latest discoveries over the past 30 years that we've made in Egypt and elsewhere on this question of the sojourn, the Exodus, and the conquest. I am going to write a couple of dates up here on the board. I have like 3 pages of notes on calculating dates, and I wisely had someone tell me that was probably not a good idea. So I'm not going to bore you with that. But I am going to write a couple dates up on the board. According to the Bible, if you crunch all the numbers, Joseph would have arrived in Egypt in about 1684 B.C., and then he would have ascended to power. I'm going to call him a vizier. I'm stealing that term, but that speaks to a man of high authority, or a position of high authority in the Middle East. He comes to that position in 1671 B.C., approximately. Now, those dates are important because we need to look in the archaeology at those time periods to see what we find. And I'm going to be using the chronology of this man I mentioned earlier, David Roll, who is an agnostic. Egyptian chronology is slippery business. Even though we've got an enormous amount of archaeological material, it covers huge amounts of time, and it takes a lot of work to try to figure out exactly who was when and what was when. And there have been problems with the conventional chronology for a long time. And those problems are becoming more and more evident. And this man, David Roll, has submitted what he calls the new chronology. And not only does it match up with the archaeology and the history, but they have recently applied astronomy to it. This is pretty cool. We now, because of all the things we've learned, we can use computer programs, and we can look at what the sky looked like at any place and any time in the world's history. And with David Roll's chronology, we had a span of 39 new moons that the Egyptians had kept track of. This new moon is 29 days after this one. This new moon was 30 days. And the stretch. And when you tried to find somewhere in the conventional chronology that matched up with those 39 new moons, you couldn't find it. They wouldn't match up any better than flipping a coin. 53%, something like that, flipping a coin. But in David Roll's chronology, every single one lined up but one. It was off by one day, which a cloudy day could take care of that. The results are staggering. He's on the money. He might be off a few years, but he's on the money. So we're going to take his chronology, And according to his chronology, when Joseph shows up on the scene, this is the man who was Pharaoh, Amenemhat III. This man was the greatest and longest ruling king of Egyptian's 12th dynasty. He reigned 47 years. Do we have any king in Israel's history who reigned that long? I don't know. I can't remember how long Uzziah reigned, but I don't know that we have anybody who reigned that long. He reigned 47 years. And one thing very interesting about Amenemhat III's reign. We know that in Amenemhat's reign, there was a terrible and prolonged famine. And that prolonged famine, anybody want to guess what it was caused by? What was that? What's that? I'm sorry.
Drought.
That's what you would think. Lack of rain, things don't grow. But the famine that happened in Amenemhat III's reign appears not to have been caused by drought, but by flooding. The flooding was so great that for a period of time they couldn't plant at all. And that is interesting, by the way, because in Pharaoh's dream, the fat cows came out of the river, right? Because the river is the source. It floods and pushes all the silt out here, and it causes the plenty. But where did the skinny cows come from? Where did the skinny cows come from in Pharaoh's dream? They came out of the river too. They came out of the river also. Now, notice, does Amenemhat look like a happy fellow? No. Is there a pointer up here? Well, that's okay. Maybe I can check that later. No, notice like the lines under his eyes, this sad. Oh, thank you, Gordon. Okay. Now you think, well, okay, you know, those Egyptians were pretty good artists. They sure know how to make a guy look glum. But compare it to Thutmose III. Now, this guy looks pretty happy. And you say, well, Thutmose must have had a great reign. Thutmose is the norm. In fact, this statue, it's a completely new style of statue. Like Kyle Stevens said a few months ago over at Gregory, it's good to be Pharaoh. Life as Pharaoh was pretty good. And almost uniformly, if not uniformly, pharaohs are depicted with this happy or at least, you know, moderate expression on their face. This is highly unusual, if not entirely unique. Only he and his father, who served, they served as co-regents for 20 years. They're the only ones, as far as I know, that have expressions like this on their face. Now, why would that be? Well, it's speculation, but might it be because of what happened during their reign? Way down on the southern Egypt, there is a very narrow part of the Nile. I think this was probably taken by Google Maps. This is north, I believe. Over here on the west and east, you can see the remains of two fortresses. In Amenemhat's day, these fortresses were there to protect the kingdom from people coming north up through the river and coming into the kingdom. And of course, if anybody came unwelcome, they probably got to meet the Egyptian fleet that was available at the time. In Amenemhat III's reign, he added to the responsibilities of these fortresses, and he gave them the responsibility of monitoring the annual flood. Now, I don't know if you can tell here, but the banks are very steep. In fact, it's really kind of like a gorge. And it's narrow, and the banks are steep. So when the floodwaters come down from Ethiopia, because that's what happens, it rains in the Ethiopian highlands, and it brings all this water into the tributaries, which eventually pours in the Nile, and the water comes, and the water level rises, and we still can see the marks on the gorge sides today, where they would measure the floodwaters. Now, why would they want to know how high the floodwaters were? This is the government, mind you. Why would the government... Why might the government want to know how high the floodwaters were? Just take a guess. Taxes. That's right. When the floodwater was high, Egypt raised its taxes. You guys are going to have a good harvest this year, so we're going to have a higher percentage. When the floodwaters were low, they lowered the taxes. people make sure they have enough, and we're not going to get as much. And it was a system that worked very well. What happens during Amenemhat's reign is for a number of years, and I'm not entirely sure that from secular history we can know exactly, but we know that for a number of years, the flood water level rises by 15 feet. Now that's here where it's in a more narrow section. So when it spreads out, it's not going to be 15 feet higher. But more flood water comes in, bringing more silt, depositing more silt throughout Egypt, which results in what? Great harvests. Great harvests. But in year 20 of Amenemhat's reign, disaster strikes. The Nile floodwaters swept over the valley like a tsunami, bursting levees, drowning livestock, washing away the mud brick villages built on low-lying sandy mounds along the valley floor. Temples were flooded. The whole land came to a grinding halt as people struggled with the consequences of the abnormally gigantic flood. The floodwaters reached four times their normal height, a 30-foot above average height. And during this time, guess what? Well, you couldn't even plant the fields. And because you couldn't plant the fields, even though there was lots of water, there was no harvest. And where there was no harvest, there was no food. Genesis 45:6, Joseph told his brothers, "For these 2 years, the famine has been in the land, and there are still 5 years in which there will be neither plowing nor harvesting." Fits perfectly. The skinny cows came up out of the water, out of the river, and Joseph says, "We've not even been able to plant." Amenemhat III saw this in his reign. Now, how did the administration respond to the crisis? All right, we always expect our president and the administration to handle problems like this. The Egyptian administration needed to do the same. What did they do? Egyptian papyrus documents tell us that from this time, during these years of good floods, the Egyptian government established an agricultural office, okay, because that's the way to handle a problem, right? You create a, really though, I mean, I don't want to be too cynical here. If the government's going to get something done, it does have to create offices. And the government created an office during the years of plenty called Department of the People's Giving. Now, admittedly, we don't know nearly as much about this as I would like to know. And that's why there's a question mark after the verses there. What did Joseph tell Pharaoh? Joseph told Pharaoh, "You're going to have these years of plenty, and then you got 7 years of famine. You'd better choose a wise man." And Pharaoh said, "You look like the man." And let's read these verses. Let's read specifically what Joseph did. Genesis chapter 41. Genesis 41, we'll start in verse 33. "Now therefore let Pharaoh select a discerning and wise man and set him over the land of Egypt. Let Pharaoh do this and let him appoint officers over the land to collect one-fifth of the produce of the land of Egypt in the 7 plentiful years. And let them gather all the food of those good years that are coming and store up grain under the authority of Pharaoh, and let them keep food in the cities. Then that food shall be as a reserve for the land for the 7 years of famine, which shall be in the land of Egypt, that the land may not perish during the famine." Verse 46. "Joseph was 30 years old when he stood before Pharaoh, king of Egypt. And Joseph went out from the presence of Pharaoh and went throughout all the land of Egypt. Now in the 7 plentiful years, the ground brought forth abundantly. So he gathered up all the food of the 7 years, which were in the land of Egypt, and laid up the food in the cities. He laid up in every city the food of the fields which surrounded them. Joseph gathered very much grain as the sand of the sea until he stopped counting, for it was immeasurable." Now, I'm hopeful for more information in ensuing years. What we know now is, in these years of the good floods, the Egyptian government sets up the Department of the People's Giving. According to the Bible, Joseph was responsible for gathering from the people what they would give to care for the nation in the future times. Now, keep that in the back of your mind, because this is going to become relevant later on. Something else was done during these years of plenty when the floods weren't, when they were good. And that is, I want to read this quote to you. This man, David Roll, again, remember, he is an agnostic, and he's describing what the Egyptian government did during these years. No, and he knows, of course, that it was followed by these terrible floods. He writes, "As if guided by some remarkable premonition, a massive project was begun to construct a long canal, or perhaps widen and deepen an existing river offshoot, branching away from the Nile at Asyut," that's way down south, it branched to the west, northwest from the Nile, "and flowing northwards all the way to a natural break in the western desert escarpment where it disgorged into Fayum Basin, there to form a huge reservoir called Lake Maris in the classical literature." Now we'll have another picture a little bit later, but can't work can't. So we don't see where it's connected way down here. But what Amenemhat III initiated during the good years was the building of this huge canal that went all the way up here and emptied into what was called the Fayum Basin. And because all that water emptied into there from the river when it was flooding, it created its own lake called Lake Maris. Now, Herodotus went there. Some of you might be familiar with the name Herodotus. He's the father of history in the 300s BC. He went there. He visited this lake. He talks about how the Egyptians had constructed it. It was extremely impressive to him. Now, where the canal reaches the edge of the desert ridge, and I don't understand exactly how that works, but it comes to a place where the Egyptians built a dam, and the dam had floodgates. And of course, the floodgates would open to allow huge amounts of flood water to pour off of the Nile so it wouldn't destroy things too bad and pour into there. But if they could shut those gates when the flooding wasn't bad and force the water back up the Nile River. This seems to have been done to save Egypt from the worst of the floods. Now, you're like, okay, that's more interesting to some of us than to others. But anybody notice this? That is the name that canal has had for thousands of years. Waterway of Joseph. It's been known by that name, as far as we know, as far back as you can go. This is the name it's known by. Could we be looking at the canal that Joseph oversaw to help them prepare for the years of flooding? I think very much a possibility. In fact, likely. And there's what it looks like today. Still makes for a pretty spot. One thing that's interesting, it's just kind of an aside, but Amenemhat had his pyramid, you may have saw that, had his pyramid built overlooking this canal. What's that tell us about Amenemhat's view of things? How did he feel about this canal? I mean, you're having your pyramid built there. Pretty important part of his reign. A defining thing, if you will. And that doesn't prove anything in and of itself, but it is interesting. Now, let's keep following the story. Right at this same time, we observe in Egypt a huge shift of wealth and power. Egypt was divided into what are called nomes. These are like districts. We've got states, we've got counties, we've got cities and all that. Egypt was divided up into nomes. And the men who oversaw these nomes were called nomarchs. Monarch with the M and N switched. They were the governors, they were the ones in charge. And if you're in charge, if you're in the world power of your day, and you've got charge of a pretty sizable district, are you poor, wealthy, in between? You're pretty wealthy. These men were very wealthy, very powerful. We can see that in the tombs they constructed, which you can see to this day. There was a lot of money. There was a lot of power. But right at this time period we're talking about, something changes. The financial records of the time reveal a loss of their fortunes. No more fancy tombs are constructed. And while the nomarchs are losing all their wealth and all their power, guess whose wealth increases right at this time? Pharaoh's. Bryant Wood is an archaeologist, and listen to what he says. We get to a point in Egyptian history when all that changes and all the wealth is concentrated with the Pharaoh. What happened here? If you read the Egyptian history books, there is no explanation for it. They don't know what happened or how it happened. I mean, this was a tremendous socioeconomic change in Egypt, a very conservative country which does not change easily. But suddenly, the whole thing is turned upside down. Instead of the nomarchs leaving, having all this power and authority and wealth, it's all concentrated with the Pharaoh. The historians that leave the Bible out of the question don't know what happened. What happened? What's that? That's exactly right. When the years of famine began, Genesis 47, 13 and 14, I'll just go ahead and turn there. You can join me if you want. Genesis 47, 13 and 14. Now there was no bread in all the land, for the famine was very severe, so that the land of Egypt and the land of Canaan languished because of the famine. Verse 14. And Joseph gathered up all the money that was found in the land of Egypt and in the land of Canaan for the grain which they bought. And Joseph brought the money into Pharaoh's house. We go down to verses 16 and 17. Then Joseph said to the people, give your livestock, and I will give you bread for your livestock if the money is gone. So they brought all their livestock to him. Jumping down to verse 20. Then Joseph bought all the land of Egypt for Pharaoh. For every man of the Egyptians sold his field because the famine was severe upon them. So the land became Pharaoh's. And as for the people, he moved them into the cities from one end of the borders of Egypt to the other end. Only the land of the priests he did not buy. The historians are looking at this and they're seeing there's this huge shift of power. All the money, all the wealth, all the power goes to the Pharaoh, but we don't know why. The Bible's telling us why. I'm going to stop there. We've got about 5 more minutes. Any comments or questions? Okay. Yes, he is. Okay, now we're getting closer to my personal favorite part. We're not going to get to my favorite part tonight, but we're getting closer. Genesis chapter 41, starting in verse 39. Let's notice what Pharaoh says to Joseph. Genesis 41, 39. Then Pharaoh said to Joseph, inasmuch as God has shown you all this, there is no one as discerning and wise as you. You shall be over my house, and all my people shall be ruled according to your word. Only in regard to the throne will I be greater than you. And Pharaoh said to Joseph, see, I have set you over all the land of Egypt. Then Pharaoh took his signet ring off his hand and put it on Joseph's hand, and he clothed him in garments of fine linen and put a gold chain around his neck, and he had him ride in the second chariot which he had. And they cried out before him, bow the knee. So he set him over all the land of Egypt. Pharaoh also said to Joseph, I am Pharaoh, and without your consent, no man may lift his hand or foot in all the land of Egypt. And Pharaoh called Joseph's name Zaphnath-Paaneah. All right. Zaphnath-Paaneah. If you like Bible names, even that one's too weird for our family, so go for it. Zaphnath is believed by some Egyptologists, believer or no, to stand for the common Egyptian phrase, he who is called. He who is called. Pa is the Egyptian word for the, and Anea is life. Anea is actually the correct ancient pronunciation for this word. Have we seen this word before? Ankh, A-N-K-H, sorry, A-N-K-H. That sometimes gets used, the symbol, the Ankh. Ankh means life, but this is technically the more correct pronunciation. So it appears that what Pharaoh may have been naming Joseph was he who is called the life, which would fit. You're going to save our nation. You're going to bring life to the nation. Now, why am I bringing this up? The most renowned figure of this time period, the most renowned figure in this time period, is a man named Anku in the Egyptian records. He is vizier. That is, he's been raised to this high position. He is attested to by several monuments and a papyrus document which shows that he is head over the court officials. And his name does seem to be a shortened version of a name which means the one who lives. Now that all by itself, you're like, well, that's interesting. Well, what do we know about Anku? In his days, the Department of the People's Giving was set up. Okay, that's kind of interesting. Contemporary Egyptian documents refer to the granaries of Anku. Now, why would that be significant? Yeah, Joseph was gathering up the grain, storing it away till they didn't have enough room. Anku had two sons. How many sons did Joseph have? Two sons. Now, Anku's sons had Egyptian names, but then again, so did Joseph, right? So that's not a problem at all. And Egyptian texts refer to Anku as Anku, who is called Pa'am. And A-A-M is the Egyptian word for Asiatic. And for an Egyptian, an Asiatic was someone who lived north and east. Canaan, Palestine, Syria. Does that seem like that might be important? Joseph was an Asiatic. Interestingly, and this doesn't prove anything, but it's very interesting. Later Egyptian texts refer to 110 years as the perfect lifespan. And how old did Joseph live to be? He lived to be 110. Okay. So we've got this fellow named Anku. Some interesting connections between him and Joseph. Boy, I hate to get this started and not be able to finish it, but in Anku's time, the kingdom, a palace and temple was set up in this city called Avaris. That was how the Egyptians came to know it. Avaris has been getting excavated for several decades now by a man named Manfred Bietak. He is an Austrian. And Avaris was a city full of Asiatics, of Semites. In fact, all these white dots are a whole bunch of other Semite cities, all planted smack dab in the eastern delta of Egypt. And anybody want to take a wild guess what region of Egypt Avaris is in? Goshen. It's in the land of Goshen. Everybody's up. I hope your appetite's wet for next week, because my favorite part comes next week. We're going to extend the invitation now. I like what Steve Proudfit said a number of months ago. Mentioned, you know, how we've handled the invitation in a lot of different ways. But it's an invitation. Come. So if there's anybody in the room who is not right with his or her God and wants to be, we invite you to come while we stand and sing.